Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I welcome you to another hour of Heretical Talk. My guest tonight is a true heretic, a nationalist, a man who always sticks to his guns. He is none other than Ray Goodwin. I've known Ray for several years, and we've even met in person. He's not a Johnny-come-lately to this cause, but he might even be considered an old-timer by now, though he's not that old. So, hello, Ray, and thank you for coming on my show.
Hi, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, that's good, and it's a pleasure for me, for sure. I'd like you to just start right out and tell us, in your words, if you would, how you became a nationalist, what kind of nationalist you are, to whatever extent you want to say, and just what your path was like to get to where you are now.
Okay. My development or involvement as a nationalist, well, let's say that I kind of feel like I came to it by nature, because I was in school before the, you might term them liberal leftist guilt cult became a part of any curriculum, and growing up in East Central Texas as an elementary schooler and then South Texas in high school, back in the 50s and early 60s, the country and the educational system was pretty much still in the hands of the majority culture. So it always seemed very logical to me that a nation should take care of its own first and mind its own business and treat other nations as we prefer to be treated. And above all things, never dare to assume the right to try and change any other nation's internal regime or their policies. This was our heritage, as very well expressed by our founding fathers, and especially well said in George Washington's farewell address. And I think that as long as we behaved in such a manner, we would not be perceived as hypocrites, meddlers, or bullies by anybody around the world, and we would be respected. And certainly, we've gotten away from that totally. And it's like when I went on back to school, Carolyn, in the early 90s to complete my BA degree and then went ahead and got a master's and began teaching at the local college. By then, of course, practically every faculty member had an internationalist viewpoint. Our textbooks were internationalist in content, and this old dog wasn't about to try to learn those new tricks. And so I like to think that I brought to my classroom, to my students, the vision of what nationalism was all about, what it truly was about, and the difference between it and internationalism.
And how are you allowed to say those things, Ray? You were teaching history, isn't that right?
That's right. I was teaching American history.
Okay, so it fit in.
And we were allowed a lot of latitude as instructors in this small community college here in Victoria, Texas, and I was just told that when I got the job, they handed me the textbook and said, this is the one you're supposed to use, and you can assign outside readings as you see fit, and what they required, and things like this, and so, certainly I had to follow that textbook, but I took it to task quite often. I offered alternative information, and my viewpoints were quite well received. And in actuality, Carolyn, there were two or three other faculty members that sympathized with the way I taught, and I think they kind of regretted that they couldn't pursue the same path I did. I had the advantage of already being retired from a previous job, and with income that I didn't depend on that teaching position to pay my bills, strictly. Certainly I needed the money, but if I was without that job, I could certainly survive. And being single and having my children all grown and gone, I didn't have the responsibilities that a lot of people do. And so if those people had dared to speak out or take the approach that I did, they could have suffered much more so than I. So that's why I had some latitude in how I taught. Now, as far as what type of nationalist, of course, I've always considered myself a racial nationalist, very conscious of my heritage, my ancestors, and what they've done throughout history. Race, I was taught by my father about race being a key factor in the development of any people, and being race conscious was certainly not a negative, but a very positive trait. You know, I've always said that I feel like if anybody's not proud of their ethnic heritage, whatever that is, there's something wrong with them. And so being raised in a segregated state as a child, I saw many of the benefits of separateness and not all of the tons of negatives that are heaped upon it today with those with a massive guilt complex. So I just kind of grew up that way and did a lot of reading on my own, and people who spoke for me at that time, when like Governor George Wallace, when he'd give a talk or whatever, he was in the news fairly often. Well, I agreed with a lot of what the man said. So my politics leaned in that direction, and so I just evolved as a white racial nationalist and still am very much so. And about my association with the Barnes Review, I guess a lot of your listeners are familiar with the Barnes Review. Well, it comes out every 2 months, magazine, historical magazine. It actually evolved from the quarterly Institute of Historical Review History magazine. And the Barnes Review began in 1994. There had been a dispute with the publisher and some of the staff and things like this over that IHR quarterly, and so that organization broke up, and the Barnes Review was a product of the new organization. I've subscribed to that magazine from the very start, and I received an invitation to speak at the Barnes Review's Labor Day weekend conference of 2006. It was their First Amendment conference. And while there, and delivered my speech, of course, I met Willis Carto. And my speech went over very well. It was about bias in academia and racial aspects of teaching in college these days, and or any school, really. And then I was asked later if I would submit my speech for publication. And that came out as an article in the July-August 07 issue of the book.
Let me stop you right there, Ray, because I want to ask you, you brought up some very interesting points, and one of which was academics who would like to speak more freely in the way that you did when you were teaching, and of course your teaching career was brought to a fairly quick end after two or three years.
Five years.
Okay, because you weren't following the line as well as they wanted you to. And what is the answer to this? We understand that people who have to make a living and they're in a certain career path and they don't want to get bumped off that career path, they're kind of stuck. This is our big problem today with political correctness as it is. And it's discussed a lot here on VOR. Do you have any words? I mean, it's kind of insoluble, so I'm not putting you on the spot here, but what would you say about that, if anything?
Well, that's exactly right. As I said, I was a member of the adjunct faculty, which worked out extremely well for me, and which meant I got paid by the number of classes that I taught. I got no benefits or things like this, so I was not like a regular faculty member, tenured faculty member, whatever. And, you know, the element that has control in our universities and over the printing of our textbooks and the wording of our textbooks now is so inculcated now, and they will not give up that position of power and authority without a severe fight. So I don't see us breaking their stranglehold merely by complaining. it's going to take something rather cataclysmic to change that, to put the control of our institutions back in the hands of the folks that are the majority culture. So you're okay. Right, it's practically insoluble, but I do think that every dog has his day. I think that nothing is forever, and that the pendulum doesn't swing the same way all the time. So it will change. At some point it's going to change, and it'll come raging back the other way. And I hope I'm alive to see it, but you're right.
Yes.
It's an extremely difficult problem.
Okay, well, let's get back then to the Barnes Review. So after they published your first piece, then you did another, had another kind of a major piece that was a cover article for them on the Holocaust.
That's right. That's right. I had been studying the enigma of the Holocaust since, oh gosh, about 1968, 1970, right in there, on my own, of course. And I was working a full-time job raising a family at that time, but I was an avid reader and always enjoyed history. And a friend of mine one day asked me, he was probably 10, 15 years older than I, and he asked me if I'd ever heard anything about the Holocaust not being all it's cracked up to be. And, well, I was totally shocked. I said, no, not at all. And he said, well, you know, there is evidence out that throws into question all of these tales of extermination and all. And I couldn't believe it. You know, I said, well, my goodness, I've seen all the films on television and, and the stories and the movies and everything like this. How can you argue with that? And he said, well, I have a little pamphlet if you'd like to, if you're interested, it's kind of a primer if you'd like to see it. And I said, I'd love to see it. And so he gave it to me. It was called Did 6 Million Really Die? And it really piqued my interest when I read that. I thought, well, it's something surely strange and off the wall to what I've always been told, but there were points in it that were excellent questions and evidence offered that was hard to say, well, this is just Nazi propaganda or whatever. You couldn't dismiss it that way. And that was kind of the string, Carolyn, that I grabbed a hold of and tried to keep following to see where it would lead. And then that led me to Arthur Butz's book, The Hoax of the 20th Century. And I just kept grabbing everything I could to read about the Holocaust. And so by the time I went back to school in 1990 and 91, we had to write a paper. It was really for a computer class. Ironically, you know, we had to put it into the computer and things like this. And I titled it Revisionist Perspectives on the Holocaust Extermination Thesis. And in that, I threw in years of what I had read and backed it up with citations and things like this, and did it cause a stir? Anyway, my instructor, when we were to go in, and we had to have our little index cards and with all that information of what publication we got our information out of. Anyway, I walked in there, and he had my paper in front of him. He flopped it on the desk, and he said, "You buy this?" And I thought he meant, did I buy the paper, you know, that I didn't really write it or something like that. And I said, no. And then I realized what he meant. And I said, well, sure, I buy it. I believe it because you can tell that by the way I wrote it and the information I've looked at. And he shook his head. Turned out he was a World War II vet.
And, oh, boy.
Yeah. And so it rubbed him the wrong way. But he wrote on my paper. He was very fair. He gave me an A on the paper. He wrote the top in red, of course. Though I disagree with your thesis and your conclusions, the paper is well written and well explained. And so I held on.
Well, that's great. That's great. You know, Ray, I'm going to scoot ahead here, and I'm going to tell people on my own that your paper, and probably you did some more work on it, or whatever, but it was eventually published in the Barnes Review, and it's one of the best things on the Holocaust anyone can read. And just give us the date of that issue so people can look that up if they want to.
Sure, Carolyn. That Confessions of a Holocaust Denier came out in the September-October issue of 2007.
Okay.
Carolyn, it was also reprinted in full. And let me see, I have that other one right here in their All Holocaust issue. And let's see when
this. Oh, yeah, that's very good. That's a good one.
This 2009, so it was last year. Let me see here. Special updated All Holocaust issue. It doesn't have the, like our other ones have these.
No,
I think it's
a special.
All Holocaust issue, uh-huh.
Right. Okay, and that was just last year. So if anybody wants to get that, they can get it. It's very good.
Yeah, that one may be more easily obtainable than the first one from 2007.
Right, and anyone who's really interested in the Holocaust would find that issue to be of great interest. So, all right, now I'm going to move on, continuing actually with TBR, but last week, and I don't know if you listened to that program or not, Ray, it doesn't matter, but I got into the issue of the TBR Neanderthal special issue, which was just the May issue, and talked about it a little bit, and we've had some comments, and there's a lot of controversy naturally around it, which everybody knew there always would be, and there should be, because it's not, in my mind, it's not anything that's proven or definite, but it's a very interesting proposition, and there is quite a bit of, this and that to back it up, and I'm not an anthropologist, scientific in any way, but I called Michael Bradley yesterday. And we talked for over half an hour because I wanted to find out certain answers from him about particular aspects that I was interested in. He didn't want to go into that as much as he wanted to talk about his general thesis, but that's really too big for my program to handle. So we had a nice conversation, and I did get some answers that I was looking for. They might not satisfy people, but I was interested in how he determined that the Neanderthals were monotheistic. Because I thought, how do these people from so far back, how do they know what their religious thinking was or spiritual thinking? And the answers that he gave me were for two reasons. First, because their descendants are monotheistic. That is, they're the Semites. Now, this is, of course, he believes that the Semites are the descendants of the Neanderthals, so therefore, since they are monotheistic, then the Neanderthals were, which is not real convincing to some people who would doubt that. So, but the other answer was the great difference between the sexes, the dimorphism. This is interesting to me, and probably a lot of people already know it, but that the Neanderthals were approximately, the males were 5'7", while the females were 4'8". This is the average. That's quite a difference. That's almost a foot shorter for people who aren't that tall to begin with. And the females had big hips and big bosoms. And he kind of joked that that was about all there was to them. I mean, they were so short. But these females, therefore, were not capable of doing any kind of hunting or, male-type work. They were so very different from the males. So he concludes that the males dominated over the females. Well, they probably did, and because, they're so much bigger. And then he said that, he told me that the females were engaged in weaving. That's 40,000 years ago. There was weaving. And their skirts consisted of a strip down the front and a strip down the back. And they spent their time amongst their other little duties, I guess, dressing each other's hair and weaving their clothing and so on. And this is interesting to me. And further, he said that Homo habilis, He believes that is that the Neanderthals came out of the Homo habilis, who originated about 1.7 million years ago, if I understood him correctly. And these people, I don't know if they were people. These creatures had an even greater difference between male and female. I was pushing him to get this information, and he said, "Well, the males would be about 5'10", and the females about 4'5". And I said, my, these were tiny females indeed, if this is so. And so when you just picture that, and I said, how does that happen? And he said, well, going back to certain creatures in the past, in some ape-type groups, the males could hold, the females were so small, the apes would hold them in their arms, like little children. So anyway, this powerlessness of the females is what, both physically and psychologically, because of the size difference, right, is what would leads him to say that it was male-dominant society, and so they were both monotheistic and male-dominating. And my interest is in male domination because of certain things that are talked about, not only on VOR, but in the white nationalist movement and amongst nationalists, and which I have a certain amount of sympathy for, but I would like to bring up a little question about some of it, because the Cro-Magnons evolved quite differently as to sexes, and we certainly don't have that kind of major difference between our sexes. And as time goes on, it seems that we are having less distinction, and I don't know what this says to us, but I don't want to go into that right now either. But I question the value of monotheism, which is one of those things that we basically take for granted as being so far superior to polytheism or any other form of religious belief. And as from what I've said so far, do you have any comment on that?
Well, yes, I think it's fascinating, the subject matter, and the thing about the monotheism, and you really put a good question to Bradley about how did that start with them? Because see, our ancestors, my Viking ancestors and on back were polytheists and nature worshippers, or whatever their gods were, if they even worship at all. And you know, it just came to me, and I may be off base here, Carolyn, but I got to thinking about these two tribes, the Neanderthal and the Cro-Magnon, and I think a lot of people are under the impression that the Cro-Magnon evolved from the Neanderthal, but that's certainly not true. These were two distinct tribes that did come along, and they wound up clashing with each other and things like this. But regarding this concept of monotheism, I don't know if the Neanderthals had the capability to think of something like that back then, and perhaps they did, but they could see that those around them, meaning the Cro-Magnon, had multiple spiritual or gods that they worshipped. Maybe the sun, maybe the wind, maybe the trees, anything like that. And I think that maybe somebody in that tribe thought, you know, if we can invent our own god, make it one god, it will strengthen us, bring unity to our little different groups against all outsiders. And these tribes believing in multiple gods, and different gods, would be much more difficult to unite and control via a priestly case. So the invention of a monotheism of one god, and especially when that one god that they created naturally favored them as being chosen, special, elite, the only true humans, would be very, very strong asset in uniting them for survival against all outsiders.
That's a very creative answer. I like it. It's as good as any other. It's as good as Michael Bradley's, who's working kind of backwards from what he's doing today to going backwards to what they would have been. But right. I don't think we would even know what their religious beliefs were, as you pointed out. What do you think of the whole position that's taken in this TBR magazine and with Michael Bradley? What do you think of the whole idea that we can say that that the Semites were Neanderthals?
I think what is presented in the magazine from cover to cover there lends a lot of credence to that idea. It makes a lot of sense to me. And, you know, very ironically, Carolyn, you know, I was aware that I was going to be on the show today, and you'd given me an idea that we were going to discuss this Neanderthal business.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was kind of flipping the channels yesterday and not much of a TV watcher, and all of a sudden on the History Channel I see they have this program on called Clash of the Cavemen, and it was about this very thing, that the Neanderthal versus the Cro-Magnon. And one interesting
Ray, we have to stop for the break now, so I'm going to I want you to pick this up as soon as we get back, all right?
Will do.
And, okay, so thanks, ladies and gentlemen. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
A Lithuanian court has cleared students carrying swastikas of illegally bearing symbols of Nazism. The judge's ruling that the emblem is merely a sign with an ancient history has caused anger. Critics fear it's another step towards the rehabilitation of fascist sympathisers. RT's Alexei Yeliseski reports from Lithuania.
Is this really just an effort to promote an archaeological symbol? A question asked by many Lithuanians after a group of students marched through several cities of the Baltic state carrying placards with swastikas. We turned to the event's organizer for an answer.
I wanted people to think outside the box. That's why I decided to look for a symbol which would urge them to do so. And I chose the ancient swastika, a symbol of light, fire and the universe, as a perfect match. The swastika, once a sacred symbol, is now being misinterpreted and humiliated.
It is, of course, etched forever in history as the sign of Nazi horror, but the march's organizers said the symbol of Nazism was around long before Hitler. We searched the streets of Vilnius for proof.
This is not headquarters of the SS. This balcony with swastikas belongs to a 19th century building in the heart of Vilnius, the Lithuanian capital. Historians say that swastika as a symbol is very popular in this part of the world, and it's been like that long before Adolf Hitler was born.
A professor in the city says the swastika was an ancient symbol of fire and sun in places including China and Europe, even appearing on the first Soviet banknotes.
I've come across swastika a lot in decades of archaeological research. They can be found as decorations for ancient wallets, on clay pots and hats, and they are thousands of years old.
But he is opposed to the marchers' revival of the symbol, notorious as the emblem of the Nazis. He questions their motivation in choosing a motif bonded in the public mind to a creed of extermination and hatred, rather than ancient history.
It's one thing when something is an ancient symbol of fire and prosperity. It's another when somebody tries to use it for whatever their motivation is. I don't believe they did it for their archaeological purposes.
And at first the Lithuanian authorities thought the same way. The students were originally arrested and put on trial for the illegal display of fascist symbols. But in a court decision which surprised and shocked many, they were acquitted. The judge saw no malicious intent in their actions, believing their story that they were promoting a historical symbol. A leading political activist says it's an extremely sinister and dangerous development for his country.
We see in Lithuania the process of rehabilitation of Nazi collaborators. It will be possible to draw swastikas by some painters, and these painters will be in a position to say that, well, this is after court decision.
In Lithuania, the display of both Nazi and Soviet symbols is outlawed. But many are wondering if the court's verdict may open a way for neo-Nazis to use history as a cover-up for fascist demonstrations. Alexei Roshevsky, RT, reporting from Vilnius in Lithuania.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and my guest, Ray Goodwin, was just telling us about a TV program on Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal that he just happened to coincidentally see last night before this program today. So, Ray, please continue. Maybe start where you began with that.
Yeah, Carolyn, the name of the program was Clash of the Cavemen. And, you know, I had read the Barnes Review issue about the Neanderthal connection between the Jews and the Neanderthals. And it was interesting, one of the articles in the Barnes Review, someone mentioned that since this link has been made, and you have two Jewish authors in the TBR, Michael Bradley and Stan Gooch, who have the same belief that the Jews are descendants of Neanderthals. And apparently this is not something new, might be new to us, but it's something that's been bandied about for some time. And it's very ironic that one of the writers in Barnes Review mentioned that since that time this link has been made, then there has been a much more favorable emphasis on these Neanderthals, rather than being the crude, no language, grunts, hardly different from the apes. All of a sudden now the Neanderthals are portrayed in a much more favorable light, and that is exactly what I saw in that television show, Clash of the Cavemen. And they also reveal some other things in there that have really made me think of our Semitic, well, they claim to be Semitic, the Jews of today. So I took notes while that show was going on, and one of the things that was brought out was about the difference between the Cro-Magnons and the Neanderthals. And the Cro-Magnon were not cave people. They resided wherever they were on the move to, if it's in the open plains or under trees or whatever. And when they fought, they would fight in the open or whatever. And it was brought out on the show that the Neanderthals were very best at ambush hunting rather than open hunting or combat. The Cro-Magnons had greater speed because of their physical build. Their weapons were more advanced. Their smarts was on their side. And the Neanderthals had to resort to sneak attacks and ambush to accomplish what they wanted to do.
Oh, sounds like the communists.
Yeah, sure does. The documentary shows a very favorable aspect of interbreeding with the Cro-Magnon. At first, it looked like they were going to say, no, there was no such thing as interbreeding. But then they, of course, they're showing these actors portraying Cro-Magnons and Neanderthals wending their ways and fighting with each other. And some of the female Neanderthals were captured. And when the Neanderthals got them back or managed to escape, one of them was pregnant. And they were.
What did they look like? What did they have those female Neanderthals looking like?
You know, they were made up to look like what you would kind of expect. They weren't as primitive looking as the ones in the museums.
And they probably weren't as short as what I was saying.
Well, you know what? They did describe them just as you did earlier, that you said that Bradley described them as having short legs, wide hips, things like this. That was brought out in the show as well.
Okay.
And so, but they were portrayed as being much more sympathetic and understanding type people. You know, they were like the poor animal that you have sympathy with versus the raiding Cro-Magnons who just hit, moved on. And so, let's see here. The Neanderthals have now been recast, according to this program, as founders of organized religion because of these interpretations of the Neanderthals. And they're now thought to have been very capable of human thought and emotion and compassion. Now, see, where this could come from, is your guess is as good as mine, because we're sitting here wondering how in the hell they came up with the concept of monotheism. And this television show is now telling us that they were probably the founders of organized religion.
Well, if they're the founders of organized religion, that seems to me very similar to being the founders of monotheism, because that's what we basically think of as organized religion today, right?
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, it's so dominant in Western civilization, Western societies.
Right, and once they came towards the end of the program and they brought up this, once again, that the Neanderthal was massacred into extinction or exposed to diseases that the Cro-Magnon would carry, such as respiratory-related infections, for which they had no immunity, thus the extinction of the Neanderthal. So the poor old Neanderthal was done in by those Cro-Magnon diseases, just as the Indians in North and South America were done in by diseases brought by the white folks. And all of this, of course, very politically correct BS. And so, anyway, when I watched that program, and it was informative and all, but I could definitely see what TBR had brought out as a bias towards the old Neanderthal. And once again, about that religion, that monotheism, the more I thought about that, Carolyn, of course, the development of this Messiah. And it actually, to me, turned out that the Messiah, in actuality, is the tribal group itself, the Jews, themselves as a group. And that's their monotheism. They worship themselves. And I think what they did was tweak that religion for non-Jews into a monotheism intended for everybody, expressing egalitarianism. Everyone's equal, nobody's different, all this stuff, because they saw that their version, which is very exclusive, how powerful it was in their continued existence and in their ability to accomplish things, versus the weakest aspect of it would be to deny that they were unique individuals and whatever, and this everybody's the same, this egalitarian stuff, that they tweaked their own religion and then passed it off to their enemies, and in just my opinion, that's how it has worked.
Well, it's clear that, to me it is, that Christianity and Islam developed out of Judaism, so they're all three very connected religions, which dominate a number of people in the world today, and
right.
They have a similar mindset. Now, what I'm going to express some heretical thoughts here. if there was... And I have come to doubt that a lot of these people, including Jesus, ever existed as the people
right.
they say they were. But
right.
if there was one, he represented to them a movement of reform or maybe rebellion toward the Judah-dominated territory that they were living in. Maybe these Galileans were not truly Jewish or Semites,
mm-hmm.
all of this stuff is talked about. But still, what the religion developed into over its first few hundred years purports to be an entirely new religion, but it still carried the teachings of Judaism as its source, and so does Islam. And so there you have this idea that you can't really separate. This is what is very binding, and it's a problem that, to me, is a huge problem, and well, for all the reasons that we know it is. But I just say that monotheism binds us all together, and it also makes for a very rigid way of thinking that you can't break in, which somehow connects, in my mind, with political correctness, no matter who's in control of it. And I would like to see more. This may be the female in me, I don't know, but I would like to see more freedom of thought for people, and I'm not a believer in polytheism either, particularly. I mean, it's very attractive. I like to study it. I like that it was our religion in the past. But I'm not one who wants to worship gods outside of myself in that way, period. So,
I think you have more sympathy than you might realize for that viewpoint, Carolyn. I think there's a lot of folks that feel that way. I'm one of them, of course, and I'm pleased that there are people like that, because that shows they've retained the ability to do a little thinking on their own, and I think it's a very positive thing.
Yeah, it just occurred to me that what I would like to see is knowledge based on fact as much as possible, and not based on some kind of divine revelation to somebody in the distant past or in the today, you know, in the now or whatever, because we all get our own revelation. And so the idea that somebody is going to say that, well, I got mine from God himself, and
right.
therefore you listen to me, and all these people, you know, will believe that and go along with it, because then they don't have to, as you say, think for themselves. But, yes, so it's not that I am, I want all kinds of, you know, gods floating around and everybody believing in one god or another, and, you know, all this babble and so on. I don't want that either. What I want is what I've just tried to express. And I suppose we're getting pretty far afield right now.
Well.
But do you have any last words on this? And then we'll go on to something else for a moment.
Well, I think that free thought, things are going to have to be that way for us to engage in free thought. And, yeah, I think that I speak what I'm going to say now. I think you would agree with that, hey, whatever works for an individual, I don't care what it is fine with me. I have no quarrel with it. Whatever they want to believe in spiritually for themselves, if they want to believe in a personal relationship with a God or a Savior or whatever they want to call it, if it works for them and they're at peace within with it, who am I to argue? I care not. That's their personal belief, and I would just like that same degree of respect accorded to me because of my beliefs, because I'm not going to try to push my beliefs on anyone. You can never get anywhere arguing things based on faith and spirituality, and you and I both are so used to trying to deal in facts, the truth, as we know it, and evidence to back it up, you know, whether that evidence be biologic or demographic or whatever it might be. We deal in things like that, and you cloud the issue when you go the other way and start throwing spirituality in it. And that's exactly why the Jews have made the Holocaust a religion, because once it becomes a religion, then it's futile to try to argue it or whatever, and that's what they want with it. So that's where I would close my thoughts on that particular subject with those words right there.
Well, Ray, you have put it perfectly, as you so often do, so I thank you for that. Every program, I do an Elie Wiesel watch, and this one I don't want to ignore talking about what the latest on Elie Wiesel is, and for that, I talked last week about the Wiesenthal Center benefit in Toronto, Canada, and so it has come and gone. And there was no word on what was said during the forum, but they did have a short press conference ahead of the forum, and there was a news story on it. And I think it's so funny. I've got it on my website, www.carolynyager.com, down at the bottom, and anybody who wants to see this picture of Elie Wiesel with Salman Rushdie, it's really classic Wiesel look on his face. And I have a few comments there. Looks like he's really in deep contemplation of moral issues, but I think he's just figuring out how to get out of saying anything, because the topic was, of course, the Israeli attack on the peace flotilla, which happened at that exact same time, which is not so good for this event, and good for Salman Rushdie. He's not quite as bad as a lot of these guys. And he did say that he criticized it, said they shouldn't have done what they did. But Wiesel himself declined to comment at all. He said he didn't know enough. And then he, shortly after that, he wanted to talk about Holocaust denial. And he said, made the clear statement, it's quoted here, "I believe Holocaust denial should be illegal." And well, we know that he went to Romania, where he has his foundation there too, and he made those statements. And we know that Hungary recently passed a law, unfortunately, to make Holocaust denial illegal. I don't know what the punishments are for it. But clearly, Elie Wiesel is going around trying to make Holocaust denial illegal everywhere. He wants very much to make it illegal in the United States and, of course, in Canada. And yet he's there talking about freedom of speech. This whole Wiesenthal Center benefit, the theme was freedom of speech. That's what they were discussing. And this is what supposedly the Wiesenthal Center says that's what it stands for. It represents freedom of speech. The whole thing. I think it's very humorous, and I'm still pushing on the finding out about Wiesel's tattoo, but that issue is going forward in another way. But what do you have any comments about our friend Elie?
Well, I think the Wiesel is hypocrisy personified, and yeah, he knows it, and he flaunts it, and he laughs at those who bend the knee to him and defer to him, and what he's most definitely afraid of is someone confronting him and not giving ground and holding on to what they got. And I like to do that to these Holocaust fanatics. I like to confront them, butt heads with them, and watch them get frustrated, and then they'll go into an emotional rage, screaming, name-calling, and things like this. And when they do that, you know you've beaten them. That's the only way they can handle it, because they can't go at that subject like a rational person would, using reason, logic, and forensics, and population studies and things like this, like would be done in a courtroom in a person on trial for murder, let's say. The accuser can't just go in and say, "This person, I saw him kill this other person. I saw that he's guilty of murder." That's not going to cut it. The accuser has to present evidence. There has to be a body. There has to be a method of killing. There has to be all kinds of forensics and maybe even DNA before this person is going to be convicted. He can't be convicted on the word. And, of course, the Holocaust legend is simply words, and that's all it is. There is absolutely nothing to back it up. I don't care what they keep telling us about all the information available. These Holocaust deniers are defaming the dead, and they're foolish, they're fools, they're idiots.
Well, of course, they're liars. They're the biggest liars.
Yeah,
I was talking about lies last week. I have one here. Well, finish up what you want to say first.
Well, I was just going to say, and for the Jews, it's not about the religious aspect of it at all, Carolyn, as you well know. It's about that dollar sign. It's about the money. It's about all the reparations that they get as so-called survivors of the Holocaust. And, you know, I know.
Well, that's right. And, you know, it's power because money and power are the same for them. They know that they control the money, they have power. Because their numbers are small, they have to find ways to blackmail over the rest
Correct.
Of us. And money, they're good at that. They're sure good at money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, they have actually managed to turn our world, our whole economic thinking, into a direction in which they can benefit out of it, which they are particularly talented at. And this is this is a whole other topic. Well, I have a little piece here I want to say, speaking about their lies. I saw an AP story. Now, AP, Associated Press story, June 3rd, by Tia Goldenberg. This was the author of it, or the reporter, or whoever wrote it. And it makes a statement about the flotilla. The activists on the flotilla hope to break Israel's blockade of the Gaza Strip, imposed after the militant Hamas group violently seized power in the territory 3 years ago. Can you imagine a bigger blatant lie than that, to put that in a newspaper, in a media article,
Carolyn,
by AP, a respected supposedly, you know, organization, violently seized power when they were peacefully voted in a fair election, that everybody, they had people there checking it, saying it was a fair election, and yet they'll say things like this.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
I know, and you know, that fits perfectly with the cartoon in my local paper today. This syndicated cartoonist has drawn a picture of an Israeli soldier standing there looking down, and there's this obvious Arab with a mask on, only his eyes showing, and above the eyes is the word Hamas, and he has this ship on his shoulder, and he's pointing to that ship, and he's saying to that Israeli, I dare you to knock this ship off of my shoulder. And that infuriated me, of course, because that's saying that Hamas had that ship going into Israel and just begging it, come on, knock it off my shoulder so I can make you look bad in front of the world. So it's the same old garbage.
Yeah.
And you know, it is infuriating. It is infuriating because it's nowhere near the truth.
Yeah, however, now many people who before wouldn't say anything are seeing it so clearly. I mean, and they are speaking out too. But it amazes me, as much as I understand how the United States works, it really amazes me that President Obama, as president of this country, can ignore this the way he's done, and that we can still, at the UN, vote to block, to condemn Israel for this act. It's really beyond anybody's acceptability level, I would say. You know, it really is going beyond that.
Well, that's true. And the reason that happens to our country is because Washington, D.C. is nothing more than Tel Aviv West. That's all it is.
And you're right.
And it will do exactly what the movers behind the scenes, and not so much behind the scenes anymore, the script that's handed to them, that's what they do. And it matters not. The justice, fair play is not a part of it at all. It's whatever is on the Zionist agenda will get done.
And these Christian Zionists, I've come to see more and more that how they are such a big part of this. They are extremely powerful part of it. And here you have Christianity again at the base of the problem. I mean, this is a serious condemnation against Christianity right here, that it is such a religion that it can be so associated itself with Judaism in that way, even though not all of them do that. I realize that plenty of them don't, but that so many can, and because of this connection of the two Bibles, Old and New Testament, being together, it makes all of this trouble possible. And again, you can't talk to these people. There's no way you can speak to it when it's religious fundamentalism like that.
No, and Carolyn, that's why I've lost. That's the reason for the friends that I've lost or the closeness of friendships that I've lost over my viewpoints on the Holocaust and Jewish influence in the government. The religious aspect is the biggest fly in the ointment there, because those people have said remarks to me like, well, you realize, of course, that if you go against the Jews, you're going against God himself and all this stuff. And so, as the Jew well knows, any argument between logic and reasoning versus emotionalism, the emotionalism is going to win every time. And that's why I say on this faith-based religion stuff, when people throw that back at you, there's no sense in pursuing point with them, because they're unreachable.
Unfortunately, I have some people in my family who have come to that, and I'm really, I just can't even talk to them. So, then I have some lovely people that I know who are into that, and they're such nice people. But, you know, there's no way to talk to them. Well, before we close, I do want to mention about the Rizzoli brothers, Jim and Joe, who I had Jim Rizzoli on my program. Yeah, I had him on my program some weeks ago, and they were just suspended for 1 year from that FPAC board, Public Access Television Board, and for presenting any more programs or even participating in anyone else or helping anyone, or, you know, it's just very communistic type of thing.
Right.
And, of course, as they say, there are several Jews on there, but they've got that public opinion pretty much going their way, but I don't know what their next moves are going to be. We'll find out. But this is just the same power going on, stopping freedom of speech. Well, because they have said that they were breaking the rules. Well, the Rizzolis say that they're constantly being bombarded, or every so often, with requests to say, well, you've broken this rule, you've broken that rule. And they say, well, then they do what they need to do to comply, and then they keep changing the rules and then accusing them.
Right.
And now they say, well, they've had 26 violations over the past such and such amount of time, so now we're just going to suspend them. But this suspension is probably just to make it sound pretty good, and they will never, when a year is up, they'll vote to keep them suspended. You know, I mean, they'll never want to let them get back on again. So this is something that we'll have to talk about in a future time, but our sympathy and our appreciation goes out to Jim and Joe Rizzoli. And, you know, as usual, Ray, we have come to the end of our program. You've been a wonderful guest. I thank you very much. I don't know how well our listeners enjoyed or appreciated some of the things we talked about, but I am very glad to get them off my chest. And so I thank you for being my comrade here, and my best to you, and good night to all our listeners.
Thank you much.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.